From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the world is consumed with the coronavirus, carbon emissions have finally dropped as a result of massive lockdowns and quarantines. But the pause in emissions is likely temporary. A new report makes the link between militarism and the climate. The report, No Warming, No War, says, quote, the military itself is a huge polluter and is often deployed to sustain the very extractive industries that destabilize our climate. This climate chaos in turn leads to massive displacement, militarized borders, and the prospect of further conflict. The authors add, quote, true climate solutions, we argue, must have anti-militarism at their core. One of the report's authors is Lindsay Koshgarian, research director at the National Priorities Project, which is a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. And the full title of the report that she has co-authored is No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. Welcome to the program, Lindsay.
Thanks, Sonali.
So, of course, the work of climate change doesn't stop just because we are in this coronavirus pandemic. However, of course, carbon emissions have dropped. They're likely to go back up again once the pandemic is over, unless we actually take action. But broadly speaking, what your report is pointing to is a source of climate emissions that is often overlooked, and that is the military. How deeply intertwined is the U.S. military with the fossil fuel industry, both as a consumer of fossil fuel and an emitter of carbon emissions?
Yes, Sonali. Well, we know that the Pentagon is the world's largest single institutional emitter of fossil emissions, and we know that it, in fact, emits more than many countries do in a year under normal circumstances. As you mentioned, now we're in this strange time when, despite everything seeming to go wrong, emissions are actually clearing up significantly, and lots of people are noting clearer skies all over the world. But during normal times, and even right now, the Pentagon is both a major emitter of fossil fuels, but we also know that oil is the single largest leading cause of wars around the world, accounting for roughly half of wars in recent decades. And we know that a large part of the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend each year on the Pentagon goes toward defending the world's oil supply. So they're intertwined in many, many ways. And it's not just the Pentagon. It's also the militarization of protests in so many parts of the world. And we've seen it in the United States. But it happens elsewhere, too, where people who are trying to defend their land, indigenous peoples and native peoples frequently, are subject to state violence because of their efforts to protect the planet and protect their own health and their own lands.
How deeply does the U.S. military pollute? How much of a carbon footprint, if you will, does it have?
So we know that, like I said, the Pentagon is the largest single institutional polluter.
So in terms of, say, government institution as opposed to private corporations?
And private institution.
And
this is worldwide. You know, the Pentagon has a footprint of more than 800 military installations around the world. Each of those installations are consuming fossil fuels themselves, and there's the constant flow for the Pentagon of troops to and from these 800 military installations of, jet fighters that are both going on military missions, but also, you know, training missions or just routine sort of routine flights. One example we have is that the B-52 fighter has, when it flies for a single hour, its emissions equal that of a passenger car for 7 years. So it's a huge, huge consumer of fossil fuels. It accounts for much of the Pentagon's budget and for a large portion of the emissions of the United States.
So the largest institutional consumer of petroleum in the world, we're not talking about all the world's militaries, we're talking about just the U.S.'s military, largest in the world in terms of what it consumes. And it, as you said, it's moving around troops all the time. A lot of people talk about wanting to green the military. What does that mean? And is that enough? Is that something that can be done? I mean, I don't think you can fly a fighter jet on solar panels.
That's right. So we've heard this is a term and an idea that we've heard even from progressives, that you can green the military. And it's really just not possible. The plans that we've heard, including one from Senator Warren, included a plan for cutting back the emissions or even going carbon neutral for the United States military bases. Now, that is a significant source of emissions, but for one thing, it's really not possible if you consider the fact that we're sending troops to these locations constantly and that they're doing so under the power of fossil fuels. But there are all sorts of other things that that doesn't consider at all. You know, there are those jet fighters that I talked about, the B-52s and the F-35s and the F-15s and all of them. They burn fuel and they can't be run on solar panels or wind. Likewise, there are the troops that are consistently rotated through more than half of the countries of in the world. So it's really just not possible to run the current United States military in a way that's even remotely considered to be green.
The issue that we often get raised from our lawmakers that anytime we talk about any curtailing of the military is it is in the interest of our national security to keep funding the military, to keep it alive. Well, what is that a euphemism for? You mentioned that a big chunk of wars have been fought over oil. Is that primarily the US military fighting wars? Is that globally speaking? Is it all fossil fuels or just oil?
It is certainly significantly the US military. We know that, for instance, there's an estimate that of the Pentagon budget, which is now over $700 billion, at least $80 billion a year of that goes toward defending the world's oil supplies. And that really is sort of code for defending the world's oil supplies from other countries, you know, protecting them for the use of the United States. We hear talk about national security, but another term you'll hear frequently is national interest, which is maybe slightly more accurate if you think the national interest is aligned with the interest of the fossil fuel industry, which is exactly what this is about. It's about protecting the economic interests of the fossil fuel industry and the way that that plays into the US economy. It's about protecting US global military dominance and power. And those are things that, you know, certainly sort of serve an old traditional notion of national interest. But in a 21st century world, the coronavirus is a perfect example. We need national internationalism that's cooperative and collaborative. We need to be able to share information and share resources and coordinate on policy. And that this is something that we're seeing right now during this very scary pandemic. But those are also the exact things that we're going to need in order to successfully confront the climate crisis.
One of the things that we know the military has been deployed for historically and even currently is to police our border, to patrol the border, especially with the anti-immigrant sentiment under President Trump. You point out in your report that as climate change increases, we're going to see more migration, more cross-border migration, and the military, which not only consumes fossil fuels and is, often involved in wars for oil, is also then deployed at these borders to stop migration that's fueled by climate change. So it's basically a bludgeon against migration.
Yes, that's right. There are estimates that eventually there will be 200 million climate migrants a year. Some estimates go even higher. And we know that we're already seeing this to some degree. You know, the United States southern border has seen increasing migrants both from Mexico, but also from the rest of Latin America. And in one example, a driver of that has been the drought in El Salvador, which has sort of had cascading effects and has been one of the driving factors of El Salvadoran refugees and migrants coming and trying to cross the United States border. And of course, the United States has met that with President Trump's border wall, and we've met it by reneging on many of our commitments internationally to admit people through asylum or as refugees. And this is a pattern that we're seeing around the world, and it's a pattern that if we take a militaristic approach to climate change, and if we use the military as our major tool to deal with these refugee flows, as we are now and as we have in the past, we'll see an incredible increase in human suffering that won't address the root causes and that will cause a significant loss of human life and suffering for many people who are unfortunately the ones that have usually suffered at the hands of U.S. militarism.
And then there's this topic that you and I have talked about many times before, which is that the sheer cost of the U.S. military is so vast that it takes away from so many other programs that actually directly help people. And the moment we're in right now is such a good illustration of that. No one's talking about cutting funding to the military, yet we could lose the postal service. There's just, you know, not enough money for ordinary people being, you know, money being put directly into the pockets of the 26.5 million unemployed Americans, but there's always money for the military. That money also takes away from climate mitigation or climate change mitigation projects, right?
Yes, it does. Our current spending on renewable energy and energy efficiency by the federal government is less than 1% of the Pentagon budget. And that's been true for quite some time. But of course, under the current administration, they've looked to cut the funding for renewable energy and energy efficiency at exactly the time when we need to be spending much more. And they've also looked to fund some of the president's pet programs like the Space Force or like the Southern Border Wall. So we see billions of dollars going to those programs, and we see a starvation of programs that would help to address climate change. What we need to do is significantly shift those resources so that instead of spending more than half of the annual budget that Congress allocates on the military, we should be spending that money on addressing what is really the biggest single national security threat, which is climate change.
Now, the U.S. military, unlike the Trump administration, does accept and acknowledge that climate change is real, right? And they've planned for it, they've projected for it. We know that the military is quite good at sort of planning for disaster. They had known about the pandemic, or they had expected rather a pandemic of the kind that we are having right now, and had prepared for it. I imagine there's a whole set of documents somewhere about what to do when catastrophic climate change starts playing out. What is the military's plan as far as you know? And do they even acknowledge the fact that the military itself is a big driver of climate change?
They acknowledge it to a very limited degree. They're very much pushing the belief that it would be possible to green the military, and the military has various initiatives to cut their reliance on fossil fuel, which has dual purpose for them because they can spend less if they can cut their use on fossil fuel, and they can also get around some of the issues that they have with supply chains and war zones. If you imagine, you know, a convoy of oil trucks coming through to feed the tanks and the jets that the troops are using, you can see why they have a military interest in reducing their use. But the fact is that they can't reduce it anywhere close to enough to make a true difference. And of course, all of that is beside the point. If we weren't fighting wars all around the world and participating in conflicts everywhere all around the world, the military wouldn't need those oil convoys and those additional measures to try to reduce the use. Of course, the other issue with the Pentagon and their use of fuel is what you were talking about before. And we know that our national security and the Pentagon as line of defense against climate change are not compatible. We have very disturbing reports from the Pentagon where they openly acknowledge that climate change is a reality. They are not climate deniers. And they openly acknowledge that it will create refugee flows and all of these things that we've been talking about. And their answer to that is really to create a fortress America. Their answer to that is to keep the refugees out and to secure the oil for the use of the United States. And it's exactly the opposite of what we really need to be doing.
You point out in your report that the department's main concern with climate change is rooted in its desire to sustain its own operations, meaning they're worried about how climate change is going to impact militarism as opposed to how climate change will, you know, impact the country, people in the country, et cetera.
That's right. They're mapping how climate change will affect naval bases, and they're mapping how climate change will affect the military interests of the Pentagon in terms of our military dominance around the world and how it could create additional, you know, conflict and insecurity around the world. And they're thinking about that in terms of where the Pentagon will need to fight. And so all of this is really counterproductive. And essentially, it's looking toward a world where instead of fighting fewer wars over oil, we're fighting more wars and involved in more conflicts in more places.
Why is addressing the U.S. military's climate change impact also an issue of racial justice?
Well, we know that globally, the people who have suffered the most from U.S. militarism are mostly Black and brown people. We know that the people who are disproportionately suffering the effects of climate change, both in the United States and around the world, are disproportionately Black and brown people. And we know that it has been the United States and other Western countries that have used far more than our fair share of fossil fuels as a resource, and that we're now looking to the global south to basically clean up the mess that we've made and make them accountable for reducing their energy use. And so it's building on the historical fact that U.S. militarism and U.S. Hoarding of resources has always taken the worst toll on Black and brown people, and that's true around the world, and it's true right here in the United States.
Now, broadly speaking, of course, with the U.S. being the biggest per capita emitter of fossil fuel emissions, how much would it cost us as a whole to transform our economy? And can we get that from the military budget? Because every time we talk about, you know, programs like the Green New Deal or any kind of transformation of our energy system as a whole to renewable, you hear the usual chorus of, but how are we going to pay for it? I mean, that's in fact some of the least extreme things that we hear when it comes to addressing climate change, because we still have so many lawmakers who want to deny that it even exists. But it can be done, right? And it can be done for money that we do have that we're just spending elsewhere.
Yes. And one of the most tragic, I think, comparisons is that we have an estimate that transitioning the United States energy grid to entirely renewable sources would cost about $4.5 trillion. And by comparison, what we've spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last nearly 20 years is approaching $7 trillion. So wow. If 20 years ago we had made different choices, we could have an entirely renewable energy grid by now, and we would have money to spare. And going forward, we've recommended cutting at least $350 billion a year from the Pentagon budget, which could be put toward true human needs, including addressing the climate crisis.
Do we need a cultural shift in this country to start thinking about our military in a different way? I mean, unfortunately, there's far too many Americans who might consider themselves liberal, but still have this very romantic notion of U.S. militarism and so-called national security and, you know, this idea of American exceptionalism. Do we need a cultural shift to rethink the true cost of the military and what value we actually want to put on things that matter more than a fighter jet.
So Nali, we definitely need that. And I think the good news is that it is beginning, it's underway. We know that younger people are less likely to believe in United States exceptionalism and less likely to believe that the United States is the only country that can engage in moral leadership in the world. They're much more likely to understand the consequences of US imperialism and to recognize that history that has been largely whitewashed up until now. And then, of course, we have the current coronavirus crisis, where people, unfortunately, are seeing all too clearly that we have not had our priorities in the right places. You know, we're all seeing that we hadn't invested in public health to the degree that we needed to. We haven't invested in the kind of economic equality and opportunity that would protect and shield people from some of the pain and suffering that's going on right now. So I think that we're beginning to have those conversations in a much more serious way than we have in the past. And we just need to continue to get the knowledge out there and continue to inform people about what the United States military really has been doing in our names and where our resources and tax dollars have been going, so that we can all get involved and work on making better choices.
And we know when push comes to shove, our government is willing to spend money on things that it decides are worth spending money on. But it's just a matter of prioritizing and for them to feel that grassroots pressure from below. I mean, we just passed a $2.2 trillion bill a few weeks ago that was deeply needed. But the fact is that when money is needed for life and death issues and they see the writing on the wall, they will step up. But climate change is a life and death issue. It's just a far more slow-moving disaster than the coronavirus pandemic. And so I feel like lawmakers think that they can just sweep it under the rug.
That's right. I think clearly they needed to be backed up against the wall to spend a $2 trillion package to protect people's health and to help buck up the economy. But as you say, they have done that. And it makes it completely evident that we do have the resources as a country if we just choose to use them. And really, it's up to all of us to push our leaders up against that wall when it comes to climate change and to give them no other choice than to put the resources where we need them most.
Lindsay, where can people get a hold of the report that we've just been discussing?
You can find the report at www.ips-dc.org.
And that is ips-dc.org. The name of the report is No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. And we'll post it, link to it directly from our website as well. Thank you, as always, for joining us today, Lindsay.
Fabulous. Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Lindsay Kosgerian, Research Director at National Priorities Project, which is with the Institute for Policy Studies. And we've been discussing a new report that Lindsay's co-authored. It's called No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.